We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. On today's episode, we're talking with Ian McLaughlin about libraries, books, and other media in the Harry Potter universe. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor with Emily Strand of Potterversity, essays exploring the world of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, Director of Campus Ministry and Liturgical Music at Ohio Dominican University, where I also teach in our Humanities Core program. And I collaborated with Katie on those books and on a few more on subjects such as Star Wars and Star Trek.
Those are very cool volumes as well. Well, today we are talking about libraries, books, other information media in the wizarding world and how that speaks to the world that we live in today. And for our little warm-up question, Emily, I thought that I would ask you about a character that doesn't get a whole lot of attention, but I think is a sort of very well-drawn character, and that is Madam Pince. When you were reading the books, what were your thoughts about Madam Pince?
I was scared of her. I was wanting to keep out of her way, definitely didn't want to have any library needs that I had to present to her. I know, you know, I probably had thoughts of, well, this is kind of vaguely stereotypical, but I'm not sure. But, you know, it's also such a welcome, like, of course you have a librarian like that at Hogwarts. Like, Hogwarts is this kind of stereotypical school in many ways, but, you know, it just has these magical exceptions to it. But what did you think, Katie? Did you have a more sophisticated take than that?
Yeah, no, not so much. I mean, I did find it, you know, when you think about how, like, if they'd had a good relationship with Madam Pince, like, here's who Nicholas Flamel is. Here's the book for you. You know, it could have solved a lot of problems if they could have just asked the librarian and she was helpful in any, you know, in any way.
I know, right?
But there's a part of me, Emily, that's revealing, that really loves her power.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
She has power and she is not afraid to wield it. Or her charges, which are the books.
Are the books, right.
And there's something just delightful about the viciousness with which she protects the books that I really like.
Right. And, you know, I mean, plot-wise, you really can't have that helpful of a librarian because then the kids are just going to find the information too easily and not go through the trials that they need to go through in order to find them. So, you know, this can't be Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
You know, yeah, but this tells you, like, Rupert Giles. This is how helpful librarians are.
Yeah. Yeah. I am married to a librarian, so I'm not going to complain about, I'm not going to argue with you on that. Yes.
Yes. Well, joining us today to talk about this very important topic is Ian McLaughlin, who holds a Master's of English, but also a Master's of Library and Information Science from the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and is currently a PhD student in English there as well. His work has focused on making libraries more inclusive and accessible to marginalized communities, including LGBTQ and neurodivergent individuals. His scholarship explores, as he says, quote, the intersections of different academic fields, including speculative realism, speculative fiction, neurodiversity, queer theory, library and information science, and developing outer space as a milieu-specific field for literary study, which I love. And, you know, given Emily's propensity for Star Trek and Star Wars, she loves it too. Ian's pronouns are he and they. Welcome to the show, Ian.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us, how did you first get interested in Harry Potter as a topic for scholarly study?
Well, I grew up with the series. When I was in, I think, fifth grade, my teacher read Sorcerer's Stone aloud to the class. I was very lucky at my elementary school that all the way through sixth grade, teachers would actually read us books chapter by chapter. That was in the middle of, like, the whole original controversy over Harry Potter between, the church and more secular readers. But
Was
then
there any
about
uproar in your school about the teacher reading that one to you?
a little, yeah, not from the school though. Actually, my parents made a little bit of a stink about it. There's very little in my life that has not stemmed from me being contrary. But then, so then by the time Order of the Phoenix came out, I read that the whole thing in one night. And then by the time I was in high school, I was hearing about people beginning to teach Harry Potter at the college level. And when I finally got around to finishing my bachelor's at University of New Mexico, there was a course taught there by Dr. Sherry Carmiol, Harry Potter and Philosophy. And I made it a point to get into that class, and to find out, what Harry Potter scholarship was about. That was really cool. We read a lot of Greek philosophers, a lot of Enlightenment philosophers, and just kind of compared stuff there. It was a lot of fun. I looked at the religious angles, that sort of thing. When I started my master's, I was looking around and I was like, I have, oddly enough, as a grad student, like a little bit of time, is there something I can be doing? And I stumbled across the Harry Potter Academic Conference, which was, I think it was just virtual that year because that was the first year after COVID still. And I was like, I could do this. Okay, let's do this. And just jumped in from there.
That's really great. Well, you heard us have a little conversation about our impressions of Madam Pince as a librarian, but you are actually a librarian. So we have to have you weigh in on Madam Pince. What do you think of her? Is she a bad example of a librarian, or has she just been misunderstood?
Well, I want to start by saying that I am not a working librarian. I got my degree and decided to continue on with an English PhD rather than work the job market as a
Haunt the
librarian.
stacks, yes.
Yes, precisely. I mean, Katie, you mentioned during that little talk that you consider her very well drawn, and I like that turn of phrase. That's a very apt turn of phrase for such a character that gets so little page time. But I think she's an incredibly human character. And she actually has a reputation among the students of being very helpful. In terms of finding information, she's a pain in the ass, and she's very, very strict, and she's very, very protective of the books. But in Sorcerer's Stone, they don't avoid asking her because she can't help them. They avoid asking her because they're not sure of her confidence. They're not sure that she won't repeat what they've been looking for, that they will that she will tell Snape that they're looking at the same things that he's looking for, or that he's not looking for. But red herrings. Yes, she's a very irritable character, and it's very realistic that she is so. Not because librarians are irritable, but because she's overworked. She's the only librarian at Hogwarts. It's a massive collection. She's having to help, depending on, what version of canon you're looking at, anywhere from hundreds to thousand, maybe about 1,000 students. That's a good sized school. Even at the small end, that is a good sized school. That is tons of information requests a day, metric tons a week. She's overworked. There's no mention of house elves helping her. There's no mention of student interns helping her. And she's oddly enough doing everything by hand. There's plenty. She's not a squib. She could be using magic. She could be using siphoning charms to remove, students' notes out of books. And she could be, scourgifying the shelves and, cleaning the shelves magically, but she's dusting, which I think shows her care for the books. Magic as maintenance is often done very flippantly in the books, and so her taking the time to do things by hand, I think, might be detrimental to her mental health and her professionalism, but it definitely shows her values.
And it's human, as you say. It's human.
Yes.
Yeah, I
Okay.
was just going to say, I think you must be right about not having any student interns, because if there had been student library interns at Hogwarts, Hermione would have been one.
Or maybe the Patil twin that was a Ravenclaw, or good Lord, can you imagine Luna?
No, I was just going to say, no, the books, that would not go well.
And then another reason that she's so irritable is that she's in a double bind, Madam Pince is. She's both a school librarian, so she's having to hand out information to students as young as 11 and to Gryffindors, no less. Who knows what shenanigans they get up to while they're studying. And then Hufflepuff's having to carry books, by the kitchens. Yes, she has access to, even if she doesn't use magical means of cleaning food out of books. But I mean, that gives me the willies. Meanwhile, she's also an archivist. She has to care for the only known collection of professional magical knowledge in Britain. There might be another magical library in Britain. They're not mentioned. And just like the student interns, we'd find out about it through Hermione if there was one. Oh, I couldn't find anything in the Hogwarts library, but I wrote into the, I don't know, the National Magical Archive of Britain,
Right.
and they didn't have anything either.
It's not mentioned in the bureaucratic hub, right? I mean, Department of Mysteries maybe, but no library is really mentioned
Yeah, the
now.
Department of Mysteries is a good example of a non-textual archive in the books. Well, recordings can be considered a text, and so then you have the Hall of Prophecies.
Prophecy.
But aside from that, she's having to service not just these hundreds, perhaps a thousand-ish students, but also all of the Wixes, I like to say, to gender neutral to gender neutral neuter it. All of the Wixes who are writing for, Witch Weekly, Transfiguration Today, and all of those other 11 periodicals that are mentioned throughout the series.
Yeah, I love this from your conference presentation that I saw when I saw you talk about this. I had not really thought about how Madam Pence really has these two roles that are not necessarily compatible in that she's both supposed to be granting access to irresponsible, often school children, but she's also an archivist who has to maintain the integrity of the actual materials in the collection. And those two things are, dueling, maybe creating some cognitive dissonance for her. And that's can, I think, reasonably explain some of the attitudes that she has.
Yeah, and I would certainly be irritable if I was forced to categorize Magical Me alongside, other textbooks. Like, come on now. There is also the stereotype of librarians being among the horniest individuals. So, it could go either way.
Maybe
Right,
she
true.
likes
Maybe
it. Maybe she's. I can just see her, like, surreptitiously making this end cap with all of Gilderoy Lockhart's books. A little display. A little display.
Oh my gosh.
Who
I
did
did not need
this?
that image. I'm sorry I brought it up.
I was thinking earlier, maybe she can't use magic to kind of maintain the library because there's like so much magic going on in the books themselves. Like they kind of manifest this, these various books manifest this magic, and maybe like that's why, because like additional magic to maintain them would interfere. I mean, I'm just
Yeah, but
trying to
she
come up with steam
hexes the
rolled
books. It's
eggs.
possible. It's
She
possible.
hexes
It
them.
didn't stop her from using a non-verbal spell to use Harry and Ginny's own belongings to chase them out of the library. And then
That's
just
true.
canonically, in Dumbledore's copy of Beedle the Bard, which is supposedly what was printed for Muggles, he has a note in there as well about her having some sort of protective spells on the books that caused him some grief when he was taking his notes.
Yeah, well, that rules that out.
Well, but maybe that's, people have their different magical specialties. And so maybe hexes and protection charms are her specialty It's
as
quite
opposed
possible.
to, the cleaning charms. But I think that protective as opposed to restorative nature also, it sort of suits librarianship too, in the sense that you don't want the book ever to be damaged. You don't want to have a repaired book. You'd rather have it just never have been damaged.
That's true. It's also a major part of librarianship to do book repair. Before I finished my bachelor's, I spent a couple of years as a library clerk, and one of my jobs was, if the binding was merely cracked or if a single page was falling out, to repair those minor damages. I mean, also, if you're going to use Reparo, it's not mentioned, but it's generally understood that you have to have all the pieces.
Oh, yeah.
And so, if a page is missing, at the same time, why not use, the Jimenio charm to create, copies that are for student use and then have an archive? It's
I think they need to hire you, Ian, because
at the
these
Hogwarts Library.
creative solutions to real problems are impressive.
I think part of it is just the fact that she couldn't be too central to the plot, like you mentioned. And so, the author didn't give too much thought to how she would be doing her job, just that she would be the cranky librarian, that we have all come to know and love to hate in, boarding school literature and other children's literature.
That was the thrust of the article on Madam Pence that was in Harry Potter for Nerds 2. That, just exactly what you said. And what I really appreciated about your presentation was that you see the human being in Madam Pence, not simply plot device or bad stereotype, that you were actually like, well, let's think about what's going into Madam Pence having these responses.
Yeah, because in terms of policy and in terms of how she runs her library, as far as we can tell throughout the series, she's relatively good. She could take better care of herself, which would allow herself to be a better librarian as well. Not that self-care should be put to the use of higher productivity, but it should be for its own sake. But it would. And so there's definite, room for improvement. My analysis basically was that Hogwarts was more at fault than she was for library issues.
Yeah, because of her having to do this job that really is a multi-person job. And so, yeah, the aims being a little
Absolutely.
confounded.
Absolutely. And considering that she's been in the position, I'm trying to think how far back semi-canonically she goes, at least since the beginning of Hogwarts Mystery, which was a full 7 years before Harry got to Hogwarts. Because actually, in the final year of Hogwarts Mystery, Fred and George are first years. So that's exactly 7 years before Harry starts at Hogwarts. But she's been there at least that long. And then she's there in 2010 for Magic Unleashed. So she needs to be training somebody. That's a long career. Retirement's coming, honey, and we're gonna need somebody new.
You got to be
We
able to
can't
pass it
can't just
along.
hand this over to Filch.
Or become the next Binns, just
Oh
stamping
Lord.
books as a ghost.
Nope. We've seen ghost librarians. We've seen how that works. We don't need another Ghostbusters situation.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. I think this happens to a lot of people who are knowledge workers, that you develop all this knowledge in yourself, and then it is hard to leave it to another person because it's all within you.
Yes.
Yeah, that's tricky. Yeah. So one of the things that I really like about the Hogwarts Library is, unlike, like a lot of school libraries that you see today, there are actually books in the
Yes.
library. And books
There
are
are
there.
still books in every school library that I'm aware of.
Yes, but I love the focus on books as sources of information that are
Yes.
valuable to this generation. And so I sort of wondered about what you think about the way books and access to books have been portrayed in the series, especially for us in an age where books are kind of seen as less important as a source of information, knowledge, wisdom.
Well, first of all, I think that it's a common misconception that we are seeing books as less important now. I think that reading is changing, but ebooks are books, audiobooks are books, webtoons are books. Several webtoons have been published as, paper and ink and glue books as well. L Lore Olympus, for instance. It's what books are changing, how people get information is changing, and so librarianship is changing. And so it's about getting people the information. It's not about books. But the way books are viewed in the series, there's 112 books mentioned by title in the series. And as I've mentioned previously, 11 periodicals, and then also Riddle's Diary. That is the extent of bound written knowledge mentioned in the series, including textbooks. And so they're important, but they're also part of this archaicness of Hogwarts, because that shift was already beginning when Harry Potter came out, first in what was it, 97, and then 98 in the US. That shift was beginning. And so books are a fundament of knowledge in Harry Potter, but they are not the epitome. As early as the end of Sorcerer's Stone, Hermione says, "Books and cleverness, there are more important things, friendship and bravery." And then again in Order of the Phoenix, they essentially start Dumbledore's army because book knowledge is not enough. Even in class where they had textbooks before, they were also getting practical knowledge.
Yeah, and that's the real conflict between Dolores Umbridge's Defense Against the Dark Arts and Lupin's, right? That, she wants them just reading books and he wants them actually, doing it.
Yes. Yeah. Lupin was the only Defense Against the Dark Arts professor to have a practical exam. It's quite possible that the Kerros were planning a practical, but that was
It
not
would involve
defense.
torture.
That was not defense. On the other hand, Hermione's book knowledge and Neville's, for that matter, in Goblet of Fire, the Golden Trio would not have gotten very far without book knowledge. So it really highlights this balance. You have to have the theory to be able to practice, and then you have to have the practice to really have the knowledge. And so neither is really prioritized over the other. Book knowledge takes like is prime. It's the prime knowledge. It's actually kind of reminding me of the ancient Greek practice of the trivium and then the quadrivium. The trivium were the three basic, what we would call maths, writing, and rhetoric, speech. And then the quadrivium were the more advanced versions of those, as well as as the beginnings of physical science. And so it's kind of like that. You have to have the trivium to learn the quadrivium, but that's where the real knowledge is.
Well, and I think it is important to have that be a balanced message. I think it's powerful as a balanced message because it's coming through this book in your hands, right? And so you
Oh,
are
absolutely.
experiencing the importance of a book of, and for many people, a real, paper and, as you said, paper and glue, object, and you are getting this message about the importance of books, but also balance with this importance of
Yes.
practicalities. And listeners, by the way, Ian's talks from Chestnut Hill, many of your talks from Chestnut Hill are on the Chestnut Hill YouTube channel. And so you can listen to a lot of wonderful talks there, several by Ian. And I want to say, speaking of, an important object that you hold in your hands, I think it was 2021 that you gave a talk about the smartphone, and you linked it very cleverly to the Mirror of Erised and Harry's two-way mirror that he receives from Sirius. So tell us about the connections that you made there and what it suggests about how media influences the way we take on information and ideas.
So the Mirror of Erised, shows the most desperate desire of the heart. And I linked that to social media feeds and the algorithm, which read your interests and show you more of that same interest. I talked a bit about how they have a mutual serial monogamy where each experience is unique to the individual. Serial because no matter who looks at it, it is monogamous to that person then. And then mutual because we are only looking at it. I mean, we each have multiple accounts, but we're not dealing with multiple algorithms each. It essentially boils down to the algorithm. People talk about it all kinds of ways on social media now. There's even people who jokingly pray to it. I think it's a joke.
Katie's making a really great face.
The way people during TikTok ban talks would be like, oh, hi to my Chinese spy, like now it's like, dear algorithm, please send me stuff on this.
Often yell at mine where I'm just like, do you know me? Like, you pretend to know me. Why do you keep thinking that I want to be a yoga instructor? I definitely don't want to be a yoga instructor.
I'm
Oh,
not just
man.
one of your many toys.
I guess.
And so because of recommended content algorithms, we've got this constant view of things that we want to see, which is not necessarily the deepest desire of our heart. And even Erised actually is misdescribed that way, because it only shows you things that you associate with that. Ron Weasley, for instance, he saw himself holding the House Cup, the Quidditch Cup, being Quidditch captain and head boy. These are all things that his brothers had been of note for, and he wants to be noteworthy. I think the way that Dumbledore put it was the best of them, meaning his brothers, and he gets that. He does, but he has to let go of what he's seen in the mirror. He has to find it differently. If he's head boy again, oh well, he's the second Weasley that did that. If he's Quidditch captain, he's the second Weasley that did that. Maybe he's the first one that did both, but he did neither. And in his 7th year, he would have had a shot at both, but he dropped out to help Harry with the Horcrux hunt. And he gave those up to gain notoriety that none of his brothers would have. Perhaps some of the others ended up on chocolate frog cards, right? But he's the only one that is canonically confirmed to have. He's the only one where, while their kids are on the train, somebody's going to open up a chocolate frog and go, "Another Ron Weasley, I have 7 of those," right? Just like he was Dumbledore in his 1st year.
So I love this reading because I mean, I think it's so interesting, right? That the visual display of your desire, or like you say, what you like the trappings of what you think that desire will get you is not actually, but they do get what they wanted. They just, it does not look like what the mirror had presented to them.
Yeah, it's more obvious with Harry's, of course, because all he sees are dead relatives. He cannot have that. Although it's fascinating to me that we are given the idea that the mirror actually can dredge up what all of these people actually look like.
I thought the same thing.
Now, because it is telepathic, it's possible that it could get into memories that Harry might not have access to himself and find his parents. But there's no way he saw his grandparents or his great grandparents before, ever. And so we're given the idea that these are accurate representations, but they may not be. But then with Ron, he's shown things that it is theoretically possible that he could achieve. But in both of those cases, they're signifiers. They are not the actual desire. Harry wants family. He wants community. That's his deepest desire. He wants connection.
And he gets that. He gets
And
that by
he
the
gets
end.
that exactly. I mean, he
He gets
has
the
already started
Weasleys.
to have it by the time he finds Erised, but he doesn't recognize it for what it is, which is found family.
Well,
And,
and his ultimate family portrait of himself and Ginny would have looked a lot like James and Lily, with the her with the red hair and him, he was a spitting image of his father. And
I think Ginny, personality-wise, is a great match, and I think it would have been better for Harry not to end up with somebody who was looked quite so much like his mother.
but doesn't that often happen, Ian? Doesn't it often happen? So, Ian, you also talked about the two-way mirror that Harry has, and it's like it is a source of like media communication, like the smartphone.
So I connected that to computer mediated communication. It's very, very similar to FaceTime. We get semi-confirmation that people can hear through it, because he speaks into the mirror in the Malfoy's dungeon, and help comes. But like, it's never actually said, that people can talk through it. There's always something out of frame. And with texting, with video chats, there's always something just out of frame. For instance, something could be right here where my hand is, and we could talk every day for a year, and you wouldn't know what's there unless
Right,
I
you could
turned
be
my
flipping us
computer.
off.
I could be. I
Yeah,
wasn't, I promise.
good, good.
But I could be. And I think that was the example I used in the talk, actually.
No, I think your example was people being appropriately dressed only from the waist up.
That,
Oh, yeah.
which is a very good example. I'm like, yeah,
Also,
but I'm
a
in
very
my
good
yoga
example.
pants.
Yeah, precisely, precisely.
In COVID times, there was a lot of that.
A lot of mishaps with that as well, and so like, and then so then there's also the warping of information through that, comments, personal frame of reference, all of those things, they can become distorted, like just the way that we repeat memes until they lose or change meaning, is another great example there, because it's not FaceTime, but it's still computer mediated communication. We're communicating things through these memes, and then that changes over time just because it's repeated. And then it can also create echo chambers. It kind of provides a paradoxical opportunity, though, because the very nature of this self-reflecting system, both of these, both the Erised side and the two-way mirror side, the fact that there is this self-reflecting system gives us the opportunity to break out of it. And we can shape our feed, and we can actively seek connections with others to confront and challenge our own assumptions in ways that we also couldn't before. Pre-internet, we were also in echo chambers of our neighborhoods, our small towns, and we couldn't reach outside of those to be like, oh, this is what life is like. I grew up in a small town in New Mexico, Gallup, New Mexico, and if pre-internet, I couldn't find out what life was like in the Bronx or Paris or Austin, right? And
Except
so,
through a book, maybe.
yeah,
Right.
and then again, that's going to be
TV.
mediated and framed, and I wouldn't have ways
Yeah.
to break out of that frame as easily either.
Yeah.
With challenges come opportunities, and sometimes they're the exact same thing.
Yeah, I like so we've talked about the mirror of Erised and the two-way mirror, but you also had a paper about wands as magical objects and the role that they serve in wizarding society. What was your
Yes.
thesis there?
Basically, that Wixes don't understand wands. They understand how to use wands, and because of that, they see wands only as tools. But via speculative realism, we can look at wands as they are, qua themselves, to, for, and by themselves. What is that relationship that a wand has to its wizard? Because the wand chooses the wizard. It has that agency. You can override that. Any Wix can pick up any wand and use it, so long as that Wix has been trained. But it won't be as effective as we see when Harry uses the Blackthorn wand. But it can also change sides, as happens with the Elder wand and Draco's wand. Which wand a Wix is using can dramatically affect their competency. And which I highlight with Ron using Percy's wand and Neville using his father's. Once they get their own wands, they grow before then. They can become competent before then, but their growth goes exponential once they have their own wand, or once a wand chooses them. And so wands have their own being in a way that is hinted at and we can see is true. But it's also withdrawn from us, as is the case with any object, per speculative realism.
Yeah, I think that, Ollivander is a good example of like a character who is showing us that, but we resist it. He takes the wand seriously as an agent, and he sees but he does paint it in really mystical terms, and then like nobody knows anything about wand lore. I mean, it's the last book before anybody asks anything about like, what are wands and where do they come from? And like, is there's what's going on with them? So there is this almost general cultural unwillingness to look at wands in that fashion in the wizarding world.
And then even the way that Ollivander, and I'm guessing also probably Grigorovitch, view wands is more as, yes, they have agency, but they are subservient. They look at them more as, on the level of house elves, perhaps, than as peers. And just because they have agency, right? You tell a house elf to go get you something, they can decide how they do it. You cast a spell through a wand, and it can decide it doesn't like you and the spell doesn't work as well. Even for the wand makers in the series, that is downplayed, and I think unfairly.
Ian, we're also In this age of intense book banning, sometimes for reasons that we might consider sort of traditional, and then sometimes for all these other reasons that have kind of cropped up in the world that we live in, Harry Potter is always being included on these lists of banned books from one reason to the next. I know you've written about this. What do you think about the practice of censorship and how it impacts the role of the librarian? And just the general practice of limiting access to books, especially for children.
People should get to read what they want to read. It took me a long time to
Yay.
really get to that. I was somebody who made fun of Twilight. I still don't like Twilight. I think there's a lot of stuff with Twilight that is problematic, but that's where the discussion is supposed to happen. We see a problem, we shouldn't just try to make sure that nobody has to deal with the problem. There are some problems that we can do that way, eventually, but that takes talking about the problem first. When the fat phobia and such in the Harry Potter books was first brought to my attention, it was like, oh, that's not good that it's there. What does it mean that it's there? How is that, and so instead of saying that people shouldn't read something, we should discuss how we read and why we read and what reading it does to us and what else is in there that does stuff for us. And with children, it's easy to say, like, oh, we're trying to protect them. But that's been the cry of the censor for God knows how long. And for children, books that are beyond their current understanding or that they are, those are generally unappealing to them. I remember being a child and being told, like, oh yeah, Dickens was a great writer. And I was like, okay, cool. I'm going to get one of his books from the library and I'm going to read it. And I sat down, I think it was Tale of Two Cities. And I was like, I'm just going to watch the Wishbone version.
I
Because I can't read this. I don't like this. What do you mean this
Right.
is good? Now, I may not be a Dickens fan. I'm certainly not a Dickens scholar, but I can sit down and I can read him.
Right.
My youngest kid, he wanted to read the Harry Potter books, and I was reading them aloud to him. I thought that he wasn't really getting much out of them because he was really young. He was just wanting to do what his older siblings were doing. And when he got to book four, I was reading that like the beginning of book four, Harry Potter is dark. And he turned to me and he said, I mean, was he five? He turned to me and he said, I don't think this book is for me. He just knew it wasn't for him.
With books that, have themes and things that are beyond a child's understanding or that they're not ready for, but they still find enjoyable to read, a lot of those themes are going to go right over their heads. A lot of the things that we're worried about are going to go right over their heads until later when they come back and they watch it and they go, wait, that was in there the whole time? The number of TV shows from the 90s that I've done that with.
For
I
sure.
remember, oh God, accelerated reader. I was probably fourth grade and I read Watership Down because that was the most points I could find on accelerated reader. The sheer violence and the sexual themes and the political themes of that story right over my head. Meanwhile, I was just like, this is a great story about some rabbits. Like, okay, yeah, like there's some fighting and there's some romance
It's an
and
epic
there's
bunny
some like,
story.
yeah. And then you sit down and you watch the movie.
Oh no, don't do that.
Like, I absolutely love the movie, but
Oh, really?
it was an eye opener. I only deal with children from an educational perspective. I'm not going to tell people how to parent. But I am going to tell people that, children are going to spot what they're ready to spot. And sometimes that's going to be at the cutting edge of their understanding. And it's better, at least as an educator, it is better to be someone that they can come to and talk to about the things that are on the edge of their understanding and be taken seriously, rather than be told that they shouldn't read something because of something that they're not actually going to understand yet, because they just
But
might. And
and also,
they're going to understand that you're telling them no. And almost treating them the way witches treat wands, not taking them seriously for who they are, too, for and by themselves.
So sometimes people have, I think, the wrong idea about how reading a book works. It's not as though you read the book and then you believe everything that's in it. You know,
Thank goodness.
and you shouldn't
Right?
actually be teaching your kids to read that way anyway. So I think it's a really good
Right.
opportunity. I never said no to anything my kids read, even when my daughter brought home the Barbie books, which those were the ones I was like, really? But
Now
you
she's a
know,
feminist icon.
she wasn't reading things uncritically even when she was like
Right.
six. And I
Right.
think that
Right.
we underestimate even kids' ability to read a thing and say, I don't really agree with this. Or this doesn't seem like the way I think it should have gone, and that there should be more of that. You said that we should talk about these things, and that's what I think is so important. The book is not the end point. The book is, in some ways, the starting point.
And I
Just
liked the way in your paper on this topic, I liked the way you talked about librarians as not the ones who give you the answer, but rather the ones who point you toward the book where you can find and consider the answer yourself and develop the answer yourself. And I do think that that's a really important, in terms of book bannings of Harry Potter, both, in the early days for their, supposed witchcraft content, to now when people, with the canceling, the desire to cancel, to get everybody not to read those books because of her anti-trans rhetoric, that, I think on both ends of those, there's this, the librarians are kind of caught in the middle, and they have to kind of focus on their role as just the provider of the information to allow for the critical thinking that needs to happen in a scenario.
Precisely, precisely. And then with cancel culture, like there is like it starts in a good place because, those of us who are both fans of a thing and disagree with the author, you don't want to fund what they're using their money for. But at the same time, you look at it and you go, I would not be who I am without these books. And I don't want to give up a part of myself over this. For some people, they personally cannot read it anymore. And that's fine because that is their decision for them. Where I have the issue is where we start saying, and you should not either. A real trans ally won't read Harry Potter. No, that's the true Scotsman fallacy and end of story. Meanwhile, there's also, okay, I don't want to buy new copies. I don't want to buy official merch. I don't want to go to the theme park, whatever, because that is money into JK's pocket, and then that is money into her women's fund. So like there's lines to be drawn, but everybody should get to decide where their own is. And that's where my issue with cancel culture comes in. It's somebody sits down and says, I'm going to be the cop about this, and I'm going to tell you these rules. I'm going to be the dominant socio political force here, and I'm going to set down these threats, to paraphrase Brennan Lee Mulligan. And then these threats are going to have force behind them. In their episode of Witch Please, about cancel culture and that sort of thing, Cosman and McGregor talk about being little cops. No, sorry, it wasn't on their one about censorship. It was about their Avril Lavigne conspiracy theory episode. They talk about us being on social media,
Sounds
being little
delightful.
cops, looking into every detail of images, just like I don't have the energy for that. I can tell you I don't like something without telling you that you have to not like it. It's taken me a while to get there. I've definitely said that about things.
I don't have to be in lockstep agreement with everybody whose work I, take in and think about. And like, it's impossible. We should all be different. We should have disagreement. And we've gotten very uncomfortable with that.
And then this quest for finding unproblematic art,
Yeah, good luck.
it's a grail quest. It's a grail quest.
No, somebody sent me a somebody was trying to convince me to stop using, I don't know, name it Amazon maybe or whatever, and I said, well, this, that, and the other, and I probably won't be doing that. Okay, well then you also have to stop using this. And then you have to stop using this. And then you have to Oh, they were saying somebody was running ICE ads. So you have to stop using Spotify because they were running ICE ads. And I'm like, well, I don't want to crush my teenager's life right now and become a really unpopular mom for something that's not my issue. And then I said, but I heard ICE ads on YouTube the other day. And the person was like, well, then you have to stop using YouTube. And I'm like,
Yeah,
okay.
I don't know.
At what point can I, you know, maybe I could do something else. Maybe I could go to a protest. Maybe I could write my, lawmaker. You know, maybe I could do other things that also have effect to try to voice my concern with what's going on with ICE rather than make my life extremely, difficult and inconvenient. When maybe that doesn't have much impact anyway, right? I mean, it's like if it really had a measurable impact, I don't know. Call
Well,
me a
what I like Ian about what you were talking about, the role libraries play in all of this and how libraries are responding to banning, but also cancel culture. And you have this really interesting metaphor of the caravanserai. I'm not sure I've even said that properly. And I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about that as a as an approach to this kind of you have to cancel, you shouldn't be reading, like getting all up in people's
Absolutely.
business.
So the caravanserai is this social structure and actual physical structure that originated in North Africa, the Levant, Southwest Asia, that whole stretch of the world. And it was known by several names in various languages, but they're all roughly the same thing. They are these places where anyone can come in. So long as they behave themselves. Actually, as recently as the Second Iraq War, a caravanserai refused entrance to someone to armed forces because those armed forces, if they came in, were going to harm somebody under their roof. And that's the point. Anybody can come in and have sanctuary. Right. For the Hunchback of Notre Dame fans, that's what was happening at the beginning of that movie. That's what the cathedral was. That was sanctuary. That was essentially the same thing as a caravanserai. For the John Wick fans, the hotel in John Wick, that is a caravanserai. Anybody can come in. There are ways to get excommunicated from that, as we see in the movies, but anybody can come in. And the person who has the hit on that person can also come in. They just also cannot go through on
Enact
the
violence, yeah.
until the target leaves. It centers not around policing behavior, but around hospitality. The host has the responsibility and the privilege of caring for the guest, and the guest has the responsibility and privilege of the community within and behaving within that social contract. From the caravanserai, we get the Greek agora, and we get the Roman forum, and then that turned into public forum doctrine here in the United States in constitutional law, and that's what the library is. It's a public forum. Libraries have to walk a very careful line, between getting their community everything that their community needs and accidentally showing bias. Meanwhile, they also have to look very closely at their community and see who are and try to figure out who are we not seeing, right? They have to look outside the library. They can't just look at circulation numbers and things like that because circulation numbers are people that are already coming to the library. If everybody in your library seems to be agreeing on everything, there's somebody in your community that is not coming to the library. And therefore, you librarians need to look at, the general demographic data around them as well and be like, oh, we get a lot of patrons who are X, Y, and Z, and they all are reading like these same things. So we definitely need to have these things in there. But, the other day I noticed, we've got a lot of population A actually here too, and they're not coming in. Let's do a program targeting population A so that we can help them become used to coming into the library. Let's have materials that they're going to like as well. And that's the key thing as well. Libraries are limited by space, by funding, And so they do have to remove materials once in a while, but that's always done based off of what's not coming off the shelf, what's not being used, and what's out of date.
And I just love this idea that if everybody is in agreement, you are excluding someone and you need to bring in people who are not in agreement. Like to me,
Precisely.
and this and radical hospitality, I also love how, you started with the idea of church sanctuary, right? And I to me, a fundamental religious value is radical hospitality that I think a lot of people forget about. As they're thinking about doctrine, you have to believe this, you have to believe that. But like radical caretaking hospitality and, kindness is actually and welcoming is core part of a lot of major belief systems. And I love the notion that in our, secular, big democratic republic, like that the library is serving as a kind of sanctuary space in that regard. What a phenomenal, what a really cool idea.
Absolutely.
Libraries for the win again.
Yay. Well, Ian, let's shift focus just a little bit because I want to talk about some of your other work too. At the 2024 Harry Potter Academic Conference at Chestnut Hill, I saw your excellent presentation on the thematic significance of actors taking multiple parts in Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. So, for those of you who haven't seen it, the same actor will play multiple characters. And Ian, it never occurred to me to actually think about, what is going on when you've kind of twinned the characters in these ways through the same actor's performance. And so tell us a little bit about what you discovered as you were investigating some of those crossovers.
One of my passions, much to the chagrin of many that know me, is punning. And role doubling, which is the technical term for that practice, has been akin to being a visual pun, of putting two things with the same face and different meanings next to each other in a way that creates new meanings or shows contradiction. So role doubling, as the name implies, is usually done between two roles. But in four cases in Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, it's done across three roles, and then in several others, it's done across two. And this is done in the script. For the original production, this is not something that just one director has done. This is more of an author's thing that happened in this case, rather than a performance choice.
Yeah, so and its intentionality means that it's likely to be done that way in each of the different versions. Like when a new theater company puts it on, they're going to also use the same twin, the same
Quite
what role
likely,
doubles.
yeah, quite likely, yes. And then, for the old school Harry Potter theater nerds out there, it's kind of the opposite of how Voldemort and Quirrell were done in Harry Potter musical. That was they had two actors back to back, and they would flip around depending on who was doing the talking at the time. This is literally two people who are never on stage at the same time being played by the same person. In one of those cases, which was Voldemort, Vernon Dursley, and Snape, all being played by Paul Bentall in the original West End production and written to be that way in the script, it really puts these three people who have relationships to villainy and heroism in conversation in a new way. There's some ambiguity between villainy and heroism throughout the entire Harry Potter series, but there's also this break. Harry and Voldemort are each ends of the spectrum. And then James, Snape, Lupin, McGonagall, Dumbledore, everybody else falls somewhere along that spectrum. But by putting Voldemort, Vernon Dursley, and Snape into one actor's purview, it really highlights ambiguity there in the play. And it kind of highlights three aspects of heroism, which are specific love, witnessing the past, and then action on the knowledge that you gain from that witness. And Vernon is shown to have specific love for Petunia and for Dudley when, in Harry's memory, Hagrid bursts in and he feels threatened, and he recognizes that his wife and his biological child, rather than his, adopted-ish son, are also feeling threatened. In the play, he gets between Hagrid and them. He's showing that protective potential heroism. He doesn't have specific love for Harry, and so in the context of the plot, he's still a villain, but that's there. He succeeds in a certain level of heroism there. And then Albus and Scorpius, are like, oh, well, if we can change the past, and then they are encouraged to change the past by the villain of the piece. Changing the past, trying to mess with the past, trying to edit history only causes more problems, only ever makes things worse. It's not until they all decide, you know what? We are here. Let's see the past. Let's understand the past in all of its ugliness and let it happen again. That they're able to be heroes, that they're able to resolve the plot. And then also taking action on the knowledge, witnessing the past, in the dark timeline, in the worst of all possible versions of history shown in the play, Snape actually steps into his heroism because he stops having to be Dumbledore's spy because Dumbledore does die in that version. He stops having the hope that Harry will defeat Voldemort because Harry dies in that version for real and not just that sacrificial Christ figure, death and resurrection. But he still fights. He still takes that action. And so, via those three roles being taken on in that same way, we can see kind of this relationship between villainy and heroism. And then Paul Bentall actually takes on also the role of Harry at one point because Harry has to look like Voldemort. And so then that links their two faces as well. The other that I talked about in my talk were the what I call the feminine villainy triad. And there is no ambiguity in the female villainy in Cursed Child. That triad, played by Helena Lembri, was Umbridge, Petunia, and Hooch, which actually mirrors the male villainous triad in that it is a professor, a muggle, and a side character. A major villain, a minor villain, and a muggle, I should say. And so there's no ambiguity. They're just villains. And then there's psychological over physical villainy for the feminine villain in Cursed Child. And then they are also subordinate to masculine villainy. Umbridge is a governmental official under Voldemort in the dark timeline. Petunia is a wife and mother under Vernon. Hooch is a professor under Dumbledore when we see her. She's not shown in any of the side timelines. And so they're using subjugation, shaming, coldness, but then they're also subordinate, and there's no redemption there for them, which I think is interesting to me, considering Rowling's politics, that would come off that way. There is one example of feminine heroism in Cursed Child, that's Ginny, but all she does is facilitate the emotional work of the male protagonists, which, again, odd. Considering Rowling's politics.
That's so interesting. And I love how there's a gendered element to what you uncover through that as well, which I think is really fascinating when you're looking at villainy, heroism, and you put these characters together that you wouldn't necessarily put them all together like that. But when you have the same actor playing them, and then you put them together and you look at how they relate to heroism and villainy, and then there's a gender paradigm at work. How interesting. Definitely saying
And I
something.
should note that role doubling isn't always used for that purpose. Sometimes, especially in smaller productions, it's done just
It's
for
practical.
convenience. It's not always done to do this, but it always causes it.
It's a byproduct.
I thought it was interesting. I thought it does a lot of fan service, so it's
I
doing
know.
things that I think.
Especially with the Tom Felton run happening.
Oh
Oh
my.
my.
Oh
Yes,
sure.
yes, yes.
Yeah.
Lori Kim on her podcast Harry Potter After 2020 did a fantastic episode about that and what having one of the original actors reprise a role on stage does for both the canonicity and the experience of Cursed Child. But then, again, it's a choice everybody has to make on their own whether or not they're going to go see it because again, putting on this play going to see it does put money, however small an amount per person, into Rowling's pocket, which is doing this political work. But at the same time, we still cannot police that. It's each person's individual prerogative how they go about supporting or not supporting whatever it is that they understand to be true about the world.
Well, right. And one can't even control the motivations that somebody would have for going to such a production, because I mean, I wouldn't be going to support J.K. Rowling. I would certainly only be going because I've heard so many things about, the production value and the different special effects,
And the
I
ending
was
is very
always
moving, I have to say. I thought I
I
did.
believe you. I believe you. I don't
How
like the
did
fan
really upset
service.
Kit?
I'm
Oh,
never a big
it was
fan
not
of.
cheap. Well, some of it maybe is a little cheap, but I thought I actually I'm a little sensitive to that myself, and I was definitely I enjoyed it. But that's not everybody's experience, and we don't all have to have the same experiences,
Right, exactly.
okay?
Or be going to a production for the same reason, you know?
Right.
So,
Or
oh, this
even be going
is.
to a paid version of things because, I cannot officially condone this, but there's going to be pirate videos of it. There's going to be ways. I mean, when I do my Harry Potter research, I either use copies that I own already or that I get from the library. When I was doing Cursed Child, I worked specifically off of, a free PDF version of the book and a hard copy out of the university library.
What's next for you? Are you still looking at Harry Potter? Have you got some more ideas coming up, or what you working on now?
Well, right now, in terms of extracurricular scholarship, which is an odd phrase to say, I have a couple of ideas that I want to work with. That talk on role doubling was meant to be a part one because, I did only deal with two of the triads, the others being Dudley Dursley, Carl Jenkins, and Victor Crumb. Carl Jenkins is a Cursed Child original character. And then the other being Cedric Diggory, James Potter, and then both James Potters, junior and senior, being played by the same actor as well. And then there's, so there's those to look at. And then there's the two-sided role doublings, and those all have their own themes that they deal with, whether it's rivalry or parenthood or transitions. And then for a long time, I've wanted to do an object-oriented study of the power of words in Harry Potter. I thought that led well out of my work on wands. Kind
Sure.
of complete this magic casting triad. And then I also want to do some continued work with librarianship in readings, mostly listenings really, of the series and of podcasts and such since then. I've noticed that I got some things wrong, like my stuff about like the siphoning spell. I hadn't thought about that as a possibility when I gave the talk, and I said that there weren't a lot of magical ways to care for books, and that was wrong, and so revisiting that and kind of maybe addending that would be cool as part of that cataloging spells that would be useful in a library setting would be a lot of fun.
I love the practicality of what you get up to and how it makes me
Yeah.
think along those lines.
Thank you so much, Ian, for being on the show today.
Well, thank you all so much for having me.
Well, our closing quote today comes from Headmaster Albus Dumbledore's foreword to the very popular library book Quidditch Through the Ages by Kenilworthy Wisp. And I think Ian actually referenced a similar thing in the Beedle the Bard Tales book as well, but in those Hogwarts library books. He often talks about the book itself as a library book, and so I hope you will enjoy this quote. It was with some difficulty, I must own, that I persuaded Madame Pince to part with one of her books so that it might be copied for wider consumption. Indeed, when I told her it was to be made available to muggles, she was rendered temporarily speechless and neither moved nor blinked for several minutes. Although I have removed the usual library book spells from this volume, I cannot promise that every trace has gone. Madame Pince has been known to add unusual jinxes to the books in her care. I myself doodled absentmindedly on a copy of Theories of Transubstantial Transfiguration last year, and the next moment found the book beating me fiercely round the head. Please be careful how you treat this book. Do not rip out the pages. Do not drop it in the bath. I cannot promise that Madam Pince will not swoop down on you wherever you are and demand a heavy fine. Care for your books, friends. Until next time, class dismissed. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is produced by Laurie Beckoff and edited by Lan Deer. Our announcer is Sarah Brown. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Ellsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Prinzi, Ashley Shepard, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Ellsburn.